listening to a pre-recorded interview from the archives of Prophecy Keepers Radio.
OCO.
You have been led by the Spirit to Prophecy Keepers Radio, a cooperative service of the White Roots of Peace Council. Whether it be the modern Asaga of Peru, the current Kahunas of Hawaii, today's medicine people of the Americas, the Holy Ones of Africa, shamans of the East, North, West, and South, or the present-day Atawehis of the Cherokee, we bring you the traditional elders and teachers of our modern times and their confidants from the Americas, the steppes of Asia, the Holy Land, the islands of the sea, Africa, and Australasia. We have not been conquered, and we defy the established order. This is Will Bluewater, the host of Prophecy Keepers Radio, speaking on behalf of the White Roots of Peace Council.
It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow? It's 500-year resistance. You can't break the connection. Follow?
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keeper's Prepper's Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault. Osio Ginalii Tahiju Toigu, which means, hello cousins, I'm fine, how are you? This is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from the Cumberland Plateau in east central Tennessee, the ancient home of the Aniuntikwalaski, the people of the lightning and thunder, or the military protectors of the old Cherokee Nation.
Well, hello everybody. This is your old buddy Bluewater coming to you from Booger County and the mysterious Ozarks in Mid-America. And our guest this week is Brooks Agnew of ArcOfMillionsOfYears.com. Brooks is an author, and this is a return visit. We really enjoyed our first interview with you last time you were on. How you doing, Brooks?
Oh, I'm doing fine. Finally back at North Carolina after 4 months in Texas, and just got back from a speaking and book signing tour in Utah.
Oh, wow.
Love the mountains of Utah.
I moved here from Utah by way of 6 months or so in Oklahoma City, but I lived in Utah, in and out of there.
That's a big switch from mountain country to flat country.
Yeah, well, I was looking for a place that was had a little bit more security and a little bit more water and able to grow food. And
I know what you mean.
But Utah's a little bit dry.
Yeah, if it's green, somebody paid to water it.
Yep. Yeah, you're not kidding. It was just a desert when they got there in 1847.
A salty desert.
Yeah, it was really, really interesting. So you were out in Salt Lake. I understand you got a new book coming out pretty soon.
Yeah, in January we have Volume 2, and we finally settled on a name for it. It's, of course, Ark of Millions of Years, Volume 2, but the subtitle is 2012 and the Harvest of the End Times.
Wow, that's interesting.
It's deep.
That sounds interesting. I know I was just sitting here watching Stargate and they have written into the storyline that there was some kind of race that came from somewhere else a long time ago, migrated from a different part of the galaxy and set up the gates. And that would, so it seems plausible that we came from somewhere else. And, you know, the old Battlestar Galactica story, kind of the same theme. And we had to come from somewhere.
Well, you know, one of the interesting things, my brother's chairman of physiology up at Johns Hopkins, and he's an extremely dedicated man, just totally focused on molecular biology. And one of the interesting things is for about the last 12 years, 90% of the research dollars that have been spent in healthcare have been in some form or another of research of the human genome. Now, they've done a really good job of mapping a lot of the points of, shall we call it, not points of weakness, but points of propensity toward weakness. We can enhance that or suppress that by our lifestyles, but different people have a genetic propensity for different kinds of illnesses, chronic or acute. And, of course, there's healthcare interest in trying to find cures and maybe even preventions or maybe even genetic treatments to help cure things like diabetes or nerve damage. But one of the interesting things that's coming out of it, naturally, of course, is the human genome, the map of human heredity. And the interesting thing about it is that the capabilities of the human genetic makeup, almost 90% of it could not have been developed on this planet. It's fairly conclusive that that portion of the genome, and it's significant, would never express itself on this planet. And if the evolutionists are right, it could not have developed on this planet. And if the creationists are right, it's even more peculiar, because that means that we were created somewhere else and brought here. And, of course, in our book, we try to very scientifically and historically make the case that actually both are partially true.
Well, that's what the Urantia book puts forth. Have you read the Urantia book?
No, you've always read more books than I have.
Oh, this is just something I read about 10 years ago, but the Urantia book, U-R-A-N-T-I-A, purports to be a billion-year history of the planet. And it basically says that, you know, we came here from somewhere else, and talks about how we're a member of a planetary system, and there are other planets in our system, and we're grouped according to how well progressed we are, but that we may have other planets that are closer to us, that are higher or lower than the system that we're in, and that the it is possible for people from the planetary systems that are higher than us to travel here and look and so forth. And
well, we're certainly an interesting planet for a lot of different reasons, not the least of which is it happened to be the birthplace of the Savior of the universe. But one of the interesting things that we've discovered in our research, and we're going into it a little bit more in the next book, but we certainly touched on it in the first one, is the existence of, or at least man's early detection of, ley lines or magnetic lines or energy lines in the Earth itself. Even without sophisticated equipment, it seems as though many ancient civilizations were able to not only locate the lines, but locate specific points on the Earth where hundreds and sometimes even thousands of these lines intersect. And at those points, it seems, anciently and in modern times, there is a peculiar energy, almost a healing energy or a spiritual energy that's available to those who seem to be in tune.
Yep.
I'm not going to say every tourist that goes to one of these juxtapositions is gonna feel energized, but certainly ones whose Well, if you want to approach it from a metaphysical point of view, their soul vibration happens to be in tune or susceptible to the vibrations in that area. They certainly feel something.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know my wife and I visited the, I believe it's across from the Dalles, which is the north central Oregon. The other side of the Columbia River in Washington, there is a replica of Stonehenge.
Oh, yes, I've heard of that.
Huh? It's an exact copy. And as soon as you get inside the stone, as soon as we got inside the stone circle, I asked her, I said, how do you feel? Hadn't been in there but a few seconds. And you get in there and you kind of feel like you're off plumb. I mean, you know you're standing up straight.
You know what my co-author said? We went to Stonehenge in July in England. She said, I feel heavy.
Yeah.
Sort of like her legs were made of lead.
Well, it was kind of a feeling of a little bit of disorientation. Kind of felt like, I mean, you knew you were standing straight, but kind of felt like you were leaning a little bit in here.
Mm.
In other words, slightly off balance.
Sort of like the fluid in your ears was being pulled slightly out of level.
Yes.
That's interesting.
I know. Before the interview, we were talking about ley lines, and I'd asked you if you'd ever heard of a man by the name of William Pidgeon. And William Pidgeon was a researcher. I believe he was a surveyor by trade back in the 1850s, and he was doing a survey of Cahokia, and he met an old man by the name of Decouda, D-E-C-O-O-D-A-H. Decouda was the last prophet of the Elk Nation, and Decouda taught him about magnetic lines. And William Pidgeon, P-I-D-G-E-O-N, is credited with being the first white person to ever write on the subject of magnetic lines. The book, The Traditions of Decouda, was about William Pidgeon's theory that there was a race of non-Indians who had... He couldn't fathom that Native American people could have built such a... civilization as they had there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But, based on the Native Americans he knew, he couldn't, he figured, well, they had to have been white, they had to come from somewhere else. And I know nowadays the conventional wisdom is that he was all wet, but the way I was taught by Elder John Red Hat, who was born into the Catua Society, the oral history they keep is, and they are the religion keepers for the Cherokee Nation. It's kind of like the original Cherokee Church.
Mm-hmm.
And at the turn of the century, the Catua Society held the complete sovereignty for the Cherokee Nation after it was extinguished by Congress, up to the point where the United Catua Band in 1949 was recognized by Congress. And then 1975, the Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma was recognized again. But the Catua taught that we migrated back and forth from Mexico several times. The second time we came up here, we migrated here for the first time and the second time. The jumping off place was here in the Ozarks. We always liked, mountains, mountains and woods. And then we moved from here, we moved east and encountered the mound builders, and they were a tall, light-skinned people.
Mm.
The old tradition. And we fought a war with them, and to stop the war, we agreed to intermarry with them. So that might explain why Cherokee men tend to be much taller than any other native people on the continent. Most of them are shorter than we are. They have, they have shorter trunks and shorter legs. And our women tend to be, the full-blown women tend to be, 5 feet or shorter, but but they tend to be pretty light skinned, much lighter skinned than the men.
I see.
And genetically, it's said we've always been a mixed blood people, that we've always, to this day, you can have people that are full blood Cherokees that are blonde. Well, DeSoto in 1540 commented that in his travel log that he saw red-headed children and blonde and blue-eyed children, you know, running around Cherokee streets in 1540. So that blood had to come somewhere. And then the old Catua story keepers, history keepers, say that we continued to move east and we encountered the Iroquois people, fought a really nasty war with them, and to stop that war, we agreed to stop speaking our language and start speaking theirs.
Boy, so, the compromises we make.
Yeah. Well, you know, we... And the Cherokees always had a pretty large land base, and we ended up settling in the southeast, and always had a lot of land, and we would get, you know, as we had people that would move in, you know, I would hear stories about how in the old days, if people came into our domains, we would absorb them, kind of like the Borg.
Right.
If a family was caught on our hunting grounds, we'd say, okay, you got a choice to make here. You can either join as a family, you know, no problem, we'll adopt you, you'll love us, no big deal. But if they said if the male, the husband, decides he doesn't want to do this, we'll kill him, we'll absorb the women and children. And those are the choices that were given to him. And
not a whole lot of choice.
Yeah, you know. So, and when the whites showed up, you know, we threw land at them. You know, we figured, you know, we would give them land. We had lots of land, but there's just too many of them, you know. So the traditionals, right after the first Treaty of Holston, I believe it was about 1720, they moved back to the traditional home here in Arkansas, Missouri, and they had a reservation here from 1817 till the 1830s, and then they ended up being moved, you know, a couple hundred miles west into Oklahoma. Well, that's a little history and a little background on our
American continent history is always exciting. I have to confess, for the last year, I've been studying the ancient history of England and Scotland. And of course, I visited the Agnew family castle, the hereditary sheriffs of Galloway in Scotland in July. And I found things I really didn't expect to find. Not only did I find the ancient castle built in 1319, it was in a state of refurbishment, but something the old family pictures didn't show were all of the stone shields that were mounted up in the walls of the outside of the castle, having various coats of arms and symbols in them. And, of course, passing between that castle and Roslyn Chapel, which is about 65 miles to the east, I noticed all the same symbols between the buildings. So I started doing a little research, and it turned out that Robert the Bruce, I think most people are familiar with that name now of Braveheart Day, had a son whose name was Edward the Bruce. And Edward the Bruce was a very close personal friend and vassal with Sir Andrew Agnew. And so our family lines, no doubt, shared wars and defenses and expansions and marriages over the centuries. So the Freemasons that helped build and defend Roslyn Chapel were filled with my family. So it was pretty nice to see that now when somebody asks me, well, what gives you the right to, or the authority to write this book about the creation of the earth, I can now say, well, I've got the genealogy to give me the right.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Hi, friends. This is Blue Water. Ayurvedic medicine is also called Ayurveda. It's a system of medicine that originated in India several thousand years ago. The term Ayurveda combines two Sanskrit words, Ayur, which means life, and Veda, which means science or knowledge. Ayurveda means the science of life. Ayurveda is a whole medical system which integrates and balances the body, mind, and spirit. Thus, it's considered holistic. This balance is necessary for contentment and good health. While pharmaceutical companies extract active ingredients from plants and sell them as drugs, the benefits of medicinal plants cannot be replicated because their synergistic combination of hundreds of naturally occurring phytochemicals cannot be reproduced in laboratories. This fact has been known to Ayurveda for thousands of years. The benefit comes from using the whole plant, not just the isolated ingredient. Because they contain whole herbs and fruits, Ayurvedic formulas are safer and more effective as opposed to Western formulations, which oftentimes have harmful side effects. We satisfy the health needs of our customers through safe, well-researched, and effective Ayurveda-based remedies using premier quality herbal extracts and sound manufacturing practices. We believe in Ayurveda so much, we're willing to offer you a 110% money-back guarantee. So be sure and visit india-herbs.us today and find out what this is all about.
And one of the interesting things that we ran across in our travels, of course, we wanted to look this up. We went to Glastonbury Tor. Glastonbury is a town in England, in the Mendip Hills. And it was, you know, very densely populated and wealthy 2,000 years ago. Now it's kind of country and rural, but amazing the plethora of old buildings, abbeys, churches, monuments, all kinds of things around the countryside. Well, as it turns out, I got my hands on a very old map of the area, and it's amazing. I haven't counted them all, but there's at least 200 ley lines that all intersect in Glastonbury. It's an area of incredible magnetic intersection. Not far from here, Tor is actually a hill, but it's man-made. They're quite large. Not far from here is a place called Avebury. And Avebury had such spiritual energy, hard to describe to you, but they built a stone wall, a circular wall, all the way around this settlement. And inside the wall, it just resonates with I'm going to just call it geo-energy. If you just sit there long enough, you feel like your body's packed in cotton if you're not used to it.
And now, is this stone fort near a river?
Actually, the place has been drained over the last two millennia. It used to be soggy, kind of woodland, peat, marshy kind of area, and they drained it and filled it and sort of made it more livable. So at one time, it was coastland.
Now, are you talking about there in North Carolina?
No, I'm talking about in England.
Oh, okay, because there's stone forts all throughout the southeast, and they were
exactly right.
People who were from Wales.
Yeah, exactly right. Same kind of people, same kind of custom. But when you look at the alignment of things like chapels and churches and groves where people would meet to pray, they're dead on these lines for hundreds and hundreds of miles all across England. It's clear that somebody either was an expert surveyor, which I highly doubt, or they were able to detect these magnetic flux fissures in the ground, and they attuned themselves to it, and I guess took every advantage for spiritual enlightenment and built their edifices along these lines. And interestingly enough, there's a tradition in that area that Jesus, as a youth, with Joseph of Arimathea, traveled to Glastonbury.
It's not just a tradition, Brooks. Have you heard the Glastonbury hymn?
Probably.
In
Gaelic.
I've got an old, can't remember who wrote it, but I've got an old VHS tape about Glastonbury and about the hymn. And Joseph of Arimathea was the uncle of Jesus.
Uh-huh.
And he was...
he was a metal trader.
Well, he wasn't just that. He was something called a noblesse decurio. Now, if you understand a little bit about the way politics worked in the Roman Empire, when the Roman Empire would take over an area, they would say, okay, like when they took over Egypt, they said, okay, you know, we're going to spank you, kill a bunch of people. You're going to be part of the Roman Empire. You're going to be our suzerain, which is a vassal, you know, to
correct
our rulers or to the Senate or whatever.
But we don't want to park 100,000 troops here to
right.
get in line.
Right. So what they did with the Jews is like they did with everybody else, is they gave them autonomy up to a certain point. And a lot of people, particularly the people that were into trading and so forth, were Roman citizens. And Josephus was one,
mm-hmm.
Joseph Arimathea. But Joseph, what people don't know about Joseph Arimathea was that he was in charge of all trade routes in the entire Roman Empire.
Oh, my goodness. Now, that I didn't know. But I knew even Saul of Tarsus was a Roman.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Exactly the same kind of stature.
Well, you can, you know, Rome took over Judea, a couple hundred years before Jesus was born.
Correct.
And
but it was particularly hard to maintain control over that area, so
yeah.
Not only did they apply the benefits of being a free trader with Rome, that is to say, monetary and protection, but they also applied a fair amount of terror in order to keep them in line.
Well, that's Pax Romana. They did that everywhere. And but the Jews, the Judeans were particularly, they were harder to acculturate into Rome because of their religious ideas. They
sure.
absolutely would not believe in this man-god thing. There was a 13 different cults that had gone back, you know, several thousand years, the old Greco-Roman idea that a man could become a god. And it was very easy for the Romans, you know, beginning 135 A.D. and going up to 333 A.D., once Constantine had his little vision, it was easy for them to kind of take what originally happened there in the Holy Land. Because you got to understand, up till 135, James or Jacob, Jesus' brother Jacob, was in charge of the church. They lived in peace in Jerusalem. They went to the temple every day at 3. You could be a member of the Nazarene sect, but you couldn't worship as a Jew unless you were a Jew.
That's right.
And this is the rub, you know, this is the problem that Paul and Stephen, particularly Stephen, caused. Stephen, there really wasn't any persecution of Christians until Stephen got some of the particularly the non-Jewish Gentile people.
Gentiles, correct.
Involved in revolt against Rome. Then, you know, the iron hand came down on everybody. And then, of course, Nero was a nut anyway. So, really, the best thing you do to understand that period of history is read a book by Parks called Conflict in the Church and Synagogue. But to understand the whole political system, you have to understand the way Rome worked. And Joseph Arimathea was a citizen. And he would travel. They had these fast-moving trading ships that would ply the Mediterranean oceans. They would go out through the Pillars of Hercules, go directly north to up to the southeast southwest coast of England, where they had very rich lead mines for 1,000 years before
sure
born. So they have a song. They have, you can go to Glastonbury, you can see bas reliefs and paintings on the buildings and the pubs and so forth, depicting the boy Jesus sitting in the boat, Joseph of Arimathea. I mean, it's
correct.
It's history, as far as they're concerned.
Right.
And so anyway.
And we don't really know much else about the actual youth of Jesus.
Uh-uh.
Other than, you know, maybe he was in Jerusalem when he was 12 years old.
Well, they couldn't start his ministry until he was 30. I mean,
that's correct.
Yeah, unless you're married, and listen, other people think people don't know. See, Jesus was a Torah observant Jew.
Right.
He even told he commanded everybody to observe what the Sanhedrin observed. He said, just don't do what they're doing. No, they'll act like they're acting. Hiding.
Correct.
But
even the title Rabboni means married rabbi.
Yeah. Well, plus now we know because of the Dead Sea Scroll research that's been done. Dead Sea Scroll 4QMMT has been translated by a professor at University of Hebron. And now they know he wasn't a rabbi, but they know that the title that he had was a Ribbi. And Ribbi was a title, a special smicha or ordination that was only given when the Sanhedrin was in operation. And it was only given during the Taniatic period, which is during the period of the Second Temple. And during that particular period, there was two things that were happening for a while. Hillel and his son or grandson, Gamaliel, were ordaining ribbies. And then shortly before Jesus was ordained, they changed the system where all ordinations had to be approved by the Sanhedrin, but these men, Hillel and Gamaliel, were just, I mean, you know, second only to Moses as far as teachers. And,
sure.
So Gamaliel,
well, they were the ones that developed the temple script and,
right,
and did the teaching of the creation of the earth in the temple,
right,
in the small groups.
Gamaliel, Jesus could only have been smichad or ordained by Gamaliel, and during that period of time, he had to have had, Gamaliel had to have had the permission of the Sanhedrin to ordain him. So he was an authorized teacher. He was, they also know now that the Pharisees were kind of the people's party. It was, they've gotten a bad rap, you know, for the last 2,000 years. They're beginning to understand more now. It was the Sadducees were, They were people, beginning about 100 years before Jesus was born, they were people, they were not Zadokites, they were people opposing as having the Zadok lineage that juxtaposed themselves. They came in, and the real Zadokites went to Qumran and started to write. And so it's because of these writings of a man called the Teacher of Righteousness that we know what was going on in Jerusalem, what was wrong, who the Sadducees were, and you begin to understand more about the conflict between the Sadducees and the Pharisees. And, you know,
well, it goes maybe a little deeper than that. The Sadducees did not believe in a resurrection at all. The Pharisees did.
They didn't really believe in the Holy Spirit.
Yeah, exactly right. They never thought it came.
Yeah, and so anyway, there's a lot more that's known now about Jesus and who he was and about that history and... But that's right, they were down at Glastonbury, and if it wasn't for the Roman Empire, Christianity never, they could have never have traveled safely on their missionary journeys.
Well, that's exactly right, but being on Roman trade routes and being involved in Roman business sort of gave them
sure,
diplomatic immunity as they traveled.
Absolutely.
And of course, it brought great knowledge to both areas, because culture and innovations in art and engineering were traded, and you can see it all over England. Even the viaducts and arches that held up tall buildings, all of which were of Roman origin. But besides trading all that, the people of that area, like you said, land rich, but also they were very land sensitive. And you know, getting back to these ley lines, whether they marked or enhanced pre-existent earth, energy fields or lines, they helped create meridians. They helped create, you know, routes of travel and routes of communication that still affect that area now. And it's, I guess the ancients kind of likened it to earth acupuncture.
Uh-huh.
Just certain areas of the earth, if you could gather people together and pray, it had an effect on the earth. It had an effect on the weather. It had an effect on whether volcanoes erupted. I know that sounds kind of strange, but it to them, they had hundreds and hundreds of years of perspective to go by, and it seemed as though they were in tune with their planet.
Well, Thomas O. Mills is a former guest, and he's see, a railroad man by profession, but he wrote a book called The Truth. And he was taught by the Hopi elders because he grew up on the reservation. He had that opportunity because his mother owned a restaurant in Holbrook. And years ago, because she had been kind to the Hopi when they would come in with their wagons, and she'd give them ice and let them come into the restaurant if they wanted to, they asked her to run their cultural center when they opened it. So he grew up at night, you know, as a young man and a teenager going up on the roof, and the Hopi taught him. And what they taught him was that when Native people talk about balance, they really mean balance.
Yeah, it's a balance of several forces.
Well, yeah, and they said there's no coincidence that pyramids are built along, basically, I guess, along the 30th meridian and latitude, give or take, you know. But they said that this is the ideal place because pyramid building wasn't just a religious thing. It was actually because of the mass that the pyramids had and where they would build them, they actually helped balance the planet. And he said that the Hopi taught him that the tableau, if you look down from above at the tableau at Giza, that the only symbols, there's a lot of symbols all over Egypt, but the only symbols on the pyramids in the Giza plateau are of religious significance to the Hopi. And they taught him that the eight pyramids on the Giza plateau represent eight periods of time, or eight chances. We're now in the fourth world going into the fifth. That there will have eight chances to learn how to keep our planet balanced, to keep it from flipping over, because every 3,000-4,000 years this happens, this catastrophic change.
Right, the polar shift.
Right, and this is the reason why it completely wipes out all civilization. You know, all the histories are lost, technologies are lost, and it's a start over, you know, and the Creator's going to give us eight tries. Interesting book, and you can, on the website, if you go to Thomas O. Mills into the archives, and you can get his book. It's a short book with full of pictures and ideas. It's absolutely amazing.
Well, funny you should mention that. We I'm going to Mexico City next week to take some original pictures of some pieces that I have licensed photos for the book, and then we got to looking closely at them, and some of the areas are cut off by the picture, or they're not very clear. So we're going to go down next week and take our own photographs, and we're going to wait for the right lighting and get what we want to show. But what we have found is in looking at the Sol King calendar, which is the wheeled mathematical device from which the Aztec calendar, and we believe maybe even the Magi that traveled to Bethlehem when Christ was born may have had a type of this kind of calendar. We believe it may have even been built or fashioned by Shem and enhanced by Abraham himself.
Mm-hmm.
And the power of this calendar over the centuries has been able to not only go back in time and look at things, but you can wheel it forward and look at things. For instance, the arrival of Cortez in South America, the type of ship he would be on, what he would be wearing on his head, the fact that he would be white and bearded and that they would herald him as a god was all on the calendar. Well, the interesting thing about the Sol King calendar and the mapping of what's called the precession, which is the reverse circle that the axis of the earth draws through the zodiac as we wobble. As it turns out, it takes about 25,000 and some change, we'll call it 26,000 years, to go through the zodiac with this pencil line drawn to the north and south pole of the earth. And it's basically, it's exactly 2,166 years per age. And we are now December 12th, 2012, or December 21st, 2012, coming up on the dawning of the age of Aquarius.
I'll see you.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
Hi, this is Will Bluewater speaking on behalf of Native Remedies. As the systems of the body are interrelated, proper functioning and health occurs when they are in balance and harmony, so it's important to consider taking a holistic approach to caring for your body. Provided that they are manufactured in the correct way, natural medicines can work quickly and safely to create holistic balance in the body to support systemic health, relieve ailments, and help prevent future disease. Most natural remedies do not produce negative side effects, and unlike conventional medicine, natural remedies do not just mask symptoms, but they get to the root of the problem to support health and affect healing at the same time. Most homeopathics are even safely taken by people of all ages and during pregnancy. Homeopathic medicine is actually suppressed here in the United States. Outside of this country, a large majority of medicines that are prescribed are homeopathics. Did you know that the cure for malaria was developed by the man that invented the homeopathic system? That's right. So friends, please take my advice. Visit the front page of prophecykeepers.com and click on the Native Remedies banner and find out what all the excitement's all about.
Well, besides the popularization of that, it appears as though many things, including some clear statements by Jesus to the saints when he was alive, that there will be a cataclysm of some sort, maybe even a splitting of the phases of the earth at the end of the age. And the end of the age is that day and that year. So, anyway, we go into a lot of depth into it in the book, and we pull from, of course, all the ancient resources that we can, and then try to throw in, as is our style, as much modern physics as we can to try to show that there are a synchronization of patterns of cycles like hurricanes and earthquakes and volcanoes and asteroid closeness and gravitational waves. All of these things are on their own undulations, but it appears as though when we map all that stuff together that there's a constructive interference that occurs at that time. And the sum total of all these rhythms of Earth and solar system and galaxy and universe are enough to cause a possible cataclysm at that time.
Yeah.
And yeah. It's not just the ancient Aztecs or the Olmecs or the Jews, but it's also many Indian traditions
that
talk about this period of time.
Oh, that's what my prophecy encyclopedias are all about, because they all point to the same, the Kali Yuga calendar. And
well, I know you made a prediction that basically Hurricane Katrina would be in a year. Well, this whole year would be a year of cataclysmic storms.
Did you hear about John Hogue pointed out that back in the same year that I was told in my sleep that 2005 would be the year of the Great Havoc? And as far as I'm concerned, 2005 started in September of last year. And
it's not over yet.
Yeah. But John said that that he, in several talks to audiences back in 95, he told them that either Miami or New Orleans would be destroyed by hurricane in 2005.
Well, that's pretty darn specific, isn't it?
Have you seen? You mess around with this prophecy stuff. It rubs off on you, and I think all it is Moses told a couple of people that were complaining to him that people were walking around the camp of Israel prophesying, and his attitude was, "Well, so what?" He says, "I would that everyone could be a prophet."
Sure.
The prophets were called servants, and
but that's different than a seer or a revelator.
Yeah,
they can be all three, but there are many prophets who did not want to be seers.
Yeah, seers, you have to have a stone.
Mm-hmm. Got to have the Urim and Thummim.
Yeah, or a seer stone.
Or a seer stone.
And a revelator has a a different specific meaning to it. But have you seen the prediction that just came out from Sydney Has No Horses that was announced at the tribal council meeting? It's been all over the internet here in this last week or so, and he is an Oglala. Let's see, Oglala Sioux tribe. Medicine man. He is a Sundance chief. I did a little research on him. If you look under Sydney Has No Horse, or Sydney Has No Horses, but if you look under Sydney Has No Horse on Google, you find out he's a medicine man. He's the grandson of Frank Fool's Crow. He's a Sundance chief also. But he got up in front of Cheyenne River Tribal Council back here, I believe the first week of the month, and said that he has been visited by two angels and also by Bigfoot, who was the chief that was murdered at Wounded Knee in 1890, and also by Crazy Horse and Sitting Bull. They have all warned him that, let me just read the thing here. On the computer, and we did verify the source of it, and he's going all over the place talking about this, but let me just read this thing to you.
Sure, go ahead.
4 October 2005, message by Sydney Has No Horses, medicine man. Robert Walters says, and this is in, and by the way, this entire document is certified as true and correct transcript of the council proceedings held in Eagle Butte, South Dakota on October 4, 2005, regular October session, signed by Winona Charger, Assistant Tribal Secretary, Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe. Robert Walters introduced him. He says, "Mr. Chairman, thank you in council. With us is Sydney Has No Horses. He's a medicine man from Oglala. And Mr. Chairman, he has a message that he's going to all the tribes, all the reservations, with that came out of a ceremony, and I feel it's a good message. I visited Mr. Has No Horses, and so at this time I'd like to give him the floor." Grandfather Sydney gets up and says, "Mataki Oyasan, all my relatives, I'd like to get in the middle if I could. I really don't like to use the mic. My name is Sydney Has No Horses. I'm from the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation. You probably knew my father. His name was Dawson Has No Horses. He was a Uwipi man, a powerful medicine man. And if you know a little bit about Lakota theology, Uwipi is a ceremony where they tie the messenger up in a rug, and I believe there's a tent involved, and the spirits come to them because of their the sacrifice that they're of being cooped up like that. It's a very uncomfortable situation."
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so my grandfather's name is Frank Fool's Crow, and most people heard him. He was also a powerful medicine man. 6 months ago, April 2005, we had a ceremony. In this ceremony, two angels came to me, and they talked to me, and they told us of the devastation that would happen in the islands and the Indian Ocean. They told us of the earthquakes that would hit Japan. They told us of the earthquakes that will hit South America, and they told us of the tsunami that wiped out all the people, and they told us of the hurricanes that came to Florida. The one that came to New Orleans, and the one that went to Texas. There's one more hurricane coming to wipe out another city. 2 weeks ago, we had a ceremony. Sitting Bull, he came in and he talked to me. Crazy Horse, he talks to me. Chief Bigfoot talks to me, and they asked me to go to the 7 council fires and to council people and to warn all of these fires within 6 months. There's going to be a tidal wave that will wipe out Los Angeles. Within 6 months, there's going to be an eruption in the northwest with the volcanoes. 2 eruptions within 6 months. They say from the eruptions of these volcanoes, the ash that's coming, the Missouri River, will be destroyed. They say the water that we drink from the ground is going to be no longer drinkable. These hardships are coming because God is bringing this. Whether you believe in Christianity, Native American Church, or the traditional way, if you read the Bible, we're going into the fourth seal. There's disasters coming. They're going to wipe out our children, and like the man said here, methamphetamine on our res is very bad too, if we don't stop that. it's going to destroy the next generation. Many vegetables are going to be born into our tribes. When I'm done here, I'm going to Standing Rock, and I'm going to stand in front of them, their council, and tell them the same thing I'm telling you now. This winter is going to be very cold for a long time. The ranchers are going to lose their horses and cows because it ain't going to warm up. The prices of propane is going to skyrocket, and sometimes they're not going to be able to deliver the propane to our families. The food issued in the Bible, it says one day there will be no food in the store shelves. If you look at the hurricane, a lot of the stores, there's no food on the shelves. People lost their homes. They can't drink the water. And so I come because of the mighty chiefs that talk to me and because of who I am. They tell me we need to warn the tribes. Today, I got here without announcement, but you see, but to see you all gathered like this, I know God's on my side to see you gathered. The Sisseton Wahpeton tomorrow will be gathered at 10 o'clock, and they'll hear what I have to say. The Flandreau people are going to be waiting for me tomorrow evening. I'm going up to Fort Yates here. I'm going to talk to them, even if it's after hours, and so I thank you very much for letting me come in, and I'm thankful that I got all of you together at the same time. I offer you all a handshake. My name is Sidney Hasnohorses. I'm from Batesland, South Dakota. You might want to write this down. We incorporated ourselves through the state of South Dakota to let you know that we're serious. Within 6 months, we're going to be in living hell of a world, and these chiefs have talked to me and my cousins. If you ever want a ceremony, you get a hold of us, and we'll bring you a ceremony and let you believe. But the chiefs tell me some of you have good hearts, some of you have good minds, some of you have spirituality. You are the people that will take heed on the word that I bring, and there's a lot of people that didn't believe us when everything we told them has happened. And my president, Cecilia Firethunder, I talked to her yesterday, and she supports everything. She supports because everything I told her would happen to our tribe has happened. The power of God, he knows what he's bringing us. And in 3 years, as keepers of Mother Earth, if the seven fires do not come together, there's going to be a meteorite that will be coming, and it's going to hit off of San Francisco. And they told us that the seven council fires, these seven fires, never had hate or jealousy toward each other. Well, you can't say that now. I've been trying to get the medicine man of Oglala to be in unity, but they can't, and now God asked me to come and get all the tribal councils together and all the tribes together. That's a very hard job he's giving me. I'm very nervous as I stand here in front of you, but I tried to look you all in the eye to let you know that I'm for real, and so at this time, these are food for thought, things you can think about in the next 6 months, and this is coming to us. It's very hard for me to say this, but I thank you for the little time you've given me. I thank you. Now I'm going to Standing Rock. I'll be going to every reservation. Maybe the tribal members will get together, and at least the tribal presidents will have a ceremony for all of you to hear and believe in God.
And what was the date of this?
And he signs off all my relatives, Mintaki Ayasa. That was 4 October 2005.
Well, that was significantly before any of these storms decided to develop.
Yeah, it was a month ago today. A month ago.
Well, interestingly enough, all of this fits together, and it's, you know, that is so amazing that it fits the fire in our belly for not only writing this book but for getting the word out, for people to read it.
Of course, you know what 6 months from 4 October is? April 6th.
Interesting.
Uh-huh. If you've been around Salt Lake or any of those Mormons.
Yeah, that's what a general conference.
Yeah, April 6th is the date the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints was organized.
It's also the date they claim that Jesus Christ was born.
Yep.
Well, interestingly enough, the reason that we're, well, the reason we're best-selling authors today, I think, is because people want to know this information. You know, even though I had published thousands of physics papers and technical documents over the years, those never make it into the bookstores. Very, very few people read them, even on the university level.
Well, that's right. You're Dr. Brooks Agnew, aren't you?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. Just a reminder.
But, you know, when we published the book last December, we thought it was good. Our families thought it was good. And honestly, that's how many books we thought we would sell, 10 or 12, something like that. It would
be a good, on the Art Bell Show.
Yeah, a good accomplishment. And then we get on the Art Bell Show on March 3rd or 4th or 5th, somewhere in there. And over a month period, I guess around 20 million people listened to that interview, and bam, we just shot up to the top 40 on Amazon. And it's been very strong since then. But since then, we have taken the 200 pages we took out of Volume 1 to make it sell for size reasons, and we've added to it, and now we're up to about 425 pages of Volume 2, and it's about ready. But in doing that, we discovered all of this synchronized history and modern things coming together. For instance, as I was mentioning before about the sort of acupuncture of the earth, there, at least the last 4 or 5 years that I'm aware of, even more than normal, more than the flower children of the 70s, you know, which were, I think, more into sensual sensations rather than earth sensations. Uh-huh. Now, many societies are becoming more in tune to the earth. And it may be because of environmental awareness, but I think it's because of an ancient prophecy of Elijah that he would turn the hearts of the fathers to the children and the children to the fathers. And the fathers are speaking to us from all of this ancient documentation. And what we find is that what we do and how we treat each other and how we conduct our thoughts and our spirits affects the earth. That healing the earth of its wounds and restoring its energy fields to balance requires the cleansing and reactivation of the subtle energy fields of the land, and that's tied to the people. And according to, you know, the ancient stuff that we've been able to dig up and read and write about and study, whether we are involved in total consumption and eat, drink, and be merry for tomorrow we die in free love, or whether we are saying a prayer or singing a song to the wind or doing a holy dance or, you know, applying goodwill and good feelings at energy centers around the earth, this has an effect, not just on the magnetosphere of the earth, but there's a spiritual component to the earth. And we make this very clear, even from a physics point of view, all the way down to superstring theory. There is a phase, a synchronized phase of vibrations between two forms of matter that make up this planet. It's sort of like a 5-gallon bucket full of glass marbles, and then you pour another 3 gallons of water into it. They occupy the same space, but when you get down on the molecular level of the water, there's all kinds of energy, there's all kinds of movement. There's flow, there's tides, there's charge, but in the glass it's sort of rigid and unmoving, even though it too is a liquid. So what you have in this planet is you've got a lot of space between the molecules that make up the dirt, the granite, the steel that we make our cars out of, and there's another energy. And the last, 3 or 4 years, we've written about it extensively. We still don't know anything about it. We can't even measure it, except that when we add up all the lit matter in the universe, we come up about 95% short of the matter that's supposed to be in the universe.
Yeah, they know about dark matter now. It's about 75-80% of what's out there.
Yeah, it's dark matter and, of course, subsequently, the dark energy. But you know what? That's all we know. We don't know how much it weighs. We don't know the phase of it. We don't know the charge of it. But if you go all the way down to quantum mechanics, you're not supposed to be able to explain gravity on a quantum level. This is what where general relativity falls apart. But when you get down to superstring theory, there's only one species of string.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Friends, this is Will Bluewater speaking on behalf of WiseFoods.org. Our native ancestors stored away lots of food in case of emergencies.
Thousands of years of sad experience taught them to be prepared. The traditional Hopi stored food enough to last for 7 years. So did the early Mormons. Nowadays, everyone unwisely depends on supermarkets for their food supply, and few people know that there is only a 3-day supply of food in the American food supply chain. Now, should some disaster befall us that would cause the big trucks like I used to drive to cease delivering our food, you'd be in big trouble. It is for these reasons that my family purchased a year's supply of 3 different breakfast and 10 delicious dinner entrees from wisefoods.org. These foods are freeze-dried right at the field where they are picked and processed and are fresher and more nutritious than any supermarket food. You just add hot water, and they're good for 25 years being stored. A year supply from wisefoods.org fits in an area about 4.5 feet by 4 feet by 18 inches. I can literally get it all in the back seat area of my Honda Civic. If you stay at home, you won't need to go to a FEMA refugee center should some disaster happen. Did you know that David Ramsey, David Gallagher, Laura Ingraham, and Michael Medved have also invested in Wise Foods? Why don't you visit wisefoods.org today and see why?
And if it vibrates at a high frequency, you have a heavy element, a heavy subatomic particle. If it vibrates at a low frequency, then you've got a light subatomic particle. And by the way, there's a factor of 350,000 between the light particle and the heavy subatomic particle. But somewhere in there is a very peculiar player, and we call it a graviton. I know this is going to really sound strange coming from a physicist, but it's almost as if there is a physics voice that calls matter to begin to coagulate into protons and neutrons and electrons and thus atoms and then molecules and then clumps of dust and then rock and then a planet and then a star and a solar system and so on. It's as if the voice of God speaks forward in physics and calls matter to begin to organize.
Joseph Smith wrote very specifically about this concept, and he called this thing the light of Christ. And he says it is the thing that permeates everything and everybody, and it's all throughout the universe. It's the extension of the Father that keeps everything alive and moving.
Well, now, that's partly true. It has an effect on everybody, because I'll tell you, I have met people, spirits on this earth, that have an allergic reaction to that light, to that spirit. Their souls are so dark with evil despair that they cannot stand the light.
He just said that without the light of Christ, I believe that I can't remember if it's a Book of Mormon teaching. See, he got into Masonry too, and they've got.
I think it was the Doctrine and Covenant, section 63.
Yeah, and you've got his. After he got into Masonry, there were some other teachings, but.
Well, actually, the Masons came to him, as I understand it, and he told them what the symbols meant.
Yeah, Judge Adams and some of these other guys. And there's some controversy about it because, the Freemasons nowadays trace they trace their lineage back to Tubal Cain.
Yeah, but it's a men's club.
Yeah. Well, the book
I'm sorry, I'm sorry. I don't mean to be blasphemous.
Oh, yeah.
But Freemasonry today is largely a men's club.
Yeah.
The original Freemasonry was put together, the same ordinances and rites were put together by premortal Adam.
Yeah. Yeah, there's, everything gets, sooner or later, Isaiah said of this time, that all the tables will be full of vomit, everything will be totally out of order. But this secret organization to get gain that was spoken of in the Book of Mormon talks about that they use a flaxen cord to lead you down to hell. Well, that's what Freemasons use, and they call it the
flaxen cord with a blindfold. Yeah, but all that's a mockery. You see, everything that is satanic is and we're talking about the secret combinations that that were formed with Cain by Lucifer, because Lucifer convinced Cain to commit murder for gain. And ostensibly, those secret combinations not only made their way into ancient old world and became the Nicolaitan band, but you also had it happen on the new world as it developed with the Gadianton robbers. And all of those rites and ordinances and selling of one's soul to Satan for earthly gain does exist. And you see societies, whole societies, that are extremely well organized. Organized as if they had internet in the middle of the desert and were communicating on a real-time basis. It seems as though their attacks and their murders and their suicides are as coordinated as a single-celled amoeba. And yet the righteous of the world go scattered through the wilderness as if they're not in tune at all. And I'm afraid that's the way it is. But there is a grand separation occurring, and I think we're beginning to see it. We've sensed it for a while, even in tribes and in groups and in lineages we've seen it. But now we're seeing it worldwide. We're seeing a grand separation between the wicked of the earth and the righteous of the earth, and it is occurring exactly as Paul said it would, that in the last days people would call evil good and good evil, and gosh, don't we hear that in the news every day. I think I heard Jimmy Carter say it just this morning on the radio.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. You've heard of Hugo Chavez?
Oh, yes.
President of, you know, Pat Robertson called for his assassination. Now, here's a guy.
Well, that's detestable.
Yeah, you know, here's a guy that used to be, Chavez, you know, used to be, you know, it's really interesting to look at this. You can kind of see the wheels rolling here. He was part of the military junta that took over the country some years back.
Well, I remember him in the cabbage strikes of old California.
No,
where
that's Cesar. This is Venezuela, excuse me.
Different Chavez.
Yeah, I forgot to say Venezuela. Now, he's the guy that, you know, because of they control so much oil.
I know who you're talking about now.
Right, you know, so, but, you know, they have given more rights. They're giving deeds to indigenous people. I mean, here's a guy who's, he's the modern-day Simón Bolívar. They even want to change the name of the country to the Bolivarian Republic of Venezuela. You can go to I don't speak Spanish, but I can go to their website, and they have their constitution in cartoon form so everybody can understand what's going on.
How about that?
And they have 12 cent a gallon gasoline down there. You know, a beer will cost you 40 cents.
Sounds like the common people can get along okay.
Well, yeah, this is what he's trying to do. He knows that if you do communism the right way, that it's the kingdom of God. If you do it the wrong way, it's the other way. You know.
Well, as again, communism is the mockery of consecration.
Right, exactly. But what he's offered, though, he said millions of gallons of oil up here, you know, during and after the hurricanes and to Mexico and other places. Now he's offering direct help because they own Citgo and they own the 5 refineries here in this country. We haven't built any new refineries, what, in 30 years?
So right.
And they, all of the, I live in Missouri and all of the oil in the Midwest comes up from Venezuela. But now they want to directly offer energy assistance directly to Indian tribes and organized poor groups of Americans. Now, this is going to be interesting to watch because, you know, Congress, I don't think, is going to allow this because they control all commerce through the Commerce Clause.
Right, and they do it to manipulate the classes.
Right, well,
but at least Bush knows what's going on, and he's down there right now talking to those people, and the press can make of it what they want.
Right.
He's in the right place at the right time.
Bush is in Venezuela?
Yes.
Okay. Because they just came out with this announcement a couple days ago that Hugo Chavez wants to directly help Indian tribes in North America. But he's trying to put together a commonwealth. He wants to share all oil revenue with everybody in the country. In other words, what I've heard that they're doing in the Middle East.
It's what the Saudis should have been doing all along. But they have built great animosity by making the 11,400 or so royals billionaires, and the rest of the country lives in abject poverty, almost like slavery, serving the rest of the country.
Now, in Kuwait, isn't it more equitable, the oil distribution?
Well, the money it is, the average income in Kuwait is about $100,000 a year.
Yeah.
And there is not a Kuwaiti man that holds a job in Kuwait.
Yeah.
I know my best friend just got back from Iraq, and he spent 6 months of it in Kuwait. And he said they bring in Jordanians and Malaysians and people from Singapore and work them like slaves to keep their Mercedes clean and grow their plants and greenhouses and run their salinity plants. But the Kuwaiti people themselves have become soft and fleshy.
That would happen. But a friend of mine is a real expert on this idea of all things common. And the book of Acts, talks about, how the church before and during and after the time of Jesus, they lived this way. And but the byproduct of it is, and the Book of Mormon also talks about it, and one of the e-books that I've written is called All Things Common. And in the Book of Mormon, they lived for, I believe, 5 generations, about 260 years. They said there wasn't a happier people ever lived.
Right. No poor among us.
And they said that after that, then there were some, because the byproduct of All Things Common is everybody gets rich.
Sure.
So,
but then people start in the idolatry and start, worshiping the fine linens and the gold. And
that's what
they start separating into classes. And amazingly enough, every society does this. Certain people grab a hold of the energy, the water, the land, the money, and they begin to hoard it. And then you end up with this stratification that explodes. In the early 20s in this country, it was headed toward that.
Yeah.
Everybody was prospering. They called it the Roaring 20s.
Well, and
the middle class was coming of age. It was
Huey
being
Long?
Born.
You ever heard of Huey Long?
Sure.
Kingfish? People don't know about Huey. I mean, they shot him. They killed him. He was governor of Louisiana. He's really kind of vilified and, viewed as a caricature. But this man, John Goodman did a movie about him a few years ago. But even in the movie, they didn't point out that Huey Long won a law passed that every man in the United States that made more than $1 million, every nickel, he says no man needs more than $1 million. And he was establishing share of the wealth clubs all over the country. And he was trying to, that was his idea of trying to establish. Of course, at that time, not too long after the Russian Revolution, everybody was calling it communism. Well, it was red scare, red baiting kind of stuff because, let's face it, communism doesn't work, but capitalism doesn't work in the long run either because the rich get richer and the poor get poorer.
Well, what I was going to say, in the 20s, what happened was the poor began to feel what it was like to be rich.
Yeah.
And if you'll notice, the mega rich, prior to the crash of 1929, they slowly and methodically pulled out of the market, and they were all in cash.
Yeah, and
when the crash happened, they went back in and bought up what was left for fractions of pennies on the dollar.
Uh-huh.
And so what happened is, in a few weeks, the middle class, including my grandfather, completely evaporated. And what you had were people working for 75 cents a day and people that were making $1 million a day.
Yep.
You had billionaires and you had paupers. And
yep,
there was nothing in between.
They didn't have a lot of crime back then either.
No.
Back in the 20s and 30s.
There really wasn't a need for it because everybody that would apply their muscle and a little bit of brains could be successful. And it really had been that way since the mid-1600s, unless you had some bad luck or or somebody wanted what you had and there wasn't a law around to prevent them from taking it. But everybody that wanted to work could come from anywhere in the world, whether they spoke English or not, whether they had any money or not. They could apply hard work and a little bit of brains and they could be successful. And when the capitalist system came of age right after the crash, a few families literally gained control of the world. And that's where any possible chance of a consecrated life sort of disappeared. The Mormons tried it several times. They were run out of community after community. They were given swamps. They were given deserts. They worked together. They dredged the swamps. They built Nauvoo, which was the second largest city in the entire state of Illinois, threatened to compete with Chicago for the railroad. And the mobs came down, loaded them, forced them out of their homes, and February 28, 1847, they walked across the frozen Mississippi River and headed for Salt Lake, left their brick homes, their factories, their cobble shops, their coopers, their blacksmiths, they left everything behind.
Yeah, most of them were immigrants from Northern Europe. But,
sure.
You know, they continued to try that, and up until, in 1875, Brigham, 2 years before he died, Brigham Young, I've read extensively, I graduated from BYU, I used to teach in their seminary system. The Journal of Discourses, which is looked down on today, it's kind of like, oh, don't read the Journal of Discourses, you'll lose your mind. It's kind of like, you know, the Jews say, well, don't read the Kabbalah, you'll lose your mind. But anyway, the Journal of Discourses, people don't understand, was the church, it was like the Ensign news magazine. It was the monthly periodical. Brigham got up and said...
The Morning Star.
Right. Well, the Journal of Discourses was written by several men that Brigham Young sent out all over the church to write articles and to see what was going on and to clarify doctrine and so forth and so on. But the thing, Brigham said... very publicly, he says, if the Latter-day Saints were interested in all things common, United Order, whatever they want to call it, he says they could have redeemed Zion within 2 years from the time they got out here.
Sure, they fell to the same temptations that all men fall
to. Right, he says they didn't want to. He says they were so interested in selling stuff to the miners that were going west because the gold rush happened just at the same time that the Mormons arrived out.
Sure, there was land speculation,
yeah.
Profiteering, there was even money dealing.
When they left Illinois, when they left Missouri, you know, they were actually moving into Mexico, and by the time they got to the Salt Lake, the Mexican War was going on in 1847, and then all of a sudden they're back under U.S. jurisdiction again. They were trying to get away from it. They
got
screwed and tattooed by President Buchanan. But they really didn't have a desire. They were sectarian. They had sectarian Christian backgrounds. Joseph Smith said that it was impossible. He said that you couldn't teach them truth. He said if you teach them a little truth, they would shatter into a million pieces. He says it was like trying to split wood with a pumpkin like a splitting maul. And corn dodger for a wedge. In other words, it was absolutely impossible.
Like trying to shove a camel through the eye of a needle?
Exactly. So by the 1880s, and now you see you've got this prophecy that Joseph Smith let out in the 1840s, the Doctrine and Covenants, that said that if he lived to be 85 years of age, he would once again see Jesus.
Well, he didn't, did he?
Well, he was assassinated, but he before he was assassinated, he was on horseback, he crossed the Mississippi River, he was on his way to the Rocky Mountains.
That's right.
They begged him to come back, and he said, I go like a lamb to the slaughter, but if he had lived, he would have gone to the Rockies, and the Latter-day Saints would have gone to the Rockies. He would have been there. The key to what they were supposed to do was all things common.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Hi, friends. This is Blue Water. Ayurvedic medicine is also called Ayurveda. It's a system of medicine that originated in India several thousand years ago. The term Ayurveda combines two Sanskrit words, Ayur, which means life, and Veda, which means science or knowledge. Ayurveda means the science of life. Ayurveda is a whole medical system which integrates and balances the body, mind, and spirit. Thus, it's considered holistic. This balance is necessary for contentment and good health. While pharmaceutical companies extract active ingredients from plants and sell them as drugs, the benefits of medicinal plants cannot be replicated because their synergistic combination of hundreds of naturally occurring phytochemicals cannot be reproduced in laboratories. This fact has been known to Ayurveda for thousands of years. The benefit comes from using the whole plant, not just the isolated ingredient. Because they contain whole herbs and fruits, Ayurvedic formulas are safer and more effective as opposed to Western formulations, which oftentimes have harmful side effects. We satisfy the health needs of our customers through safe, well-researched, and effective Ayurveda-based remedies using premier quality herbal extracts and sound manufacturing practices. We believe in Ayurveda so much, we're willing to offer you a 110% money-back guarantee. So be sure and visit india-herbs.us today and find out what this is all about.
But Brigham in 1875 said, you're not interested in doing this. So in 1889, you start to get these reports that Jesus is visiting the Indians in Walker Lake up through 1890. And then you have the ghost dance craze. It was originally called the Dance of Welcome. Then the whole, you know, it scared the Jesus out of the Indian agents, and the people in the press were writing a bunch of lies, and the culmination was a massacre at Wounded Knee. But
how about all, that?
I didn't know
how all that tied together.
Well, all that was going on was that in 1890, which was the appointed year, and the Book of Mormon doesn't say if, but he says it when the Gentiles sin against my gospel, that it would be given back to the remnant of Jacob, which is, according to Mormon theology, are
the Lamanites.
The native people.
Right.
And Joseph Smith's first, or was it second? It was Parley Pratt's sister. She was living in Salt Lake. She was the one that Emma Smith kicked down the stairs when she was pregnant. They were living in Nauvoo. Got fired.
That's right.
Yeah, you know. And anyway, she wrote in the Millennial Star, I believe it was, and reminding everybody, hey, folks, look at what's going on, because these reports of Jesus visiting out on the Walker Lake Indian Reservation, it was a military compound. The reports were being flashed via telegraph from Walker Lake and Schertz, Nevada, all the way to Boston, was written about in the Boston Globe. And there's all kinds of, several books that have been written. I've got Wovoka.com, but there are accounts that are buried in the archives of Boston Globe that Dr. Robert Ghostwolf has been in and seen that are not published widely nowadays. That when Jesus came, and a lot of people associate the color orange with him, but they said that when he arrived in a kind of a donut-shaped vehicle, and that the front of the donut kind of opened up and he just stepped down. And there were three witnesses. You had Wovoka, and then you had the, who was a Paiute, then you had the Arapahoes, Short Bull and Porcupine. All three of them said that they met and shook hands with Jesus, and that once you had done so, you could see him anytime you wanted to in your sleep. And then he organized them into 12, and so forth and so on. But the ramifications to the Mormon world went on like nothing ever happened. But what they don't understand is when the manifesto that was, see, they had tried to get up a manifesto during the 1880s. The third president of the church, President Taylor, said he would never sign it. It was already.
And Wilford Woodruff had to.
Yeah, and he says that, you know, President Taylor said, I won't sign it. I'd rather have my tongue torn from its roots and my right hand severed than sign that document. He says, I will leave that to my successor. And then Wilford Woodruff signed it, and that not only put an end to polygamy, everybody focuses on polygamy, but it also ended the efforts at the United Order, which was really what they were supposed to be doing. It was the heart and soul of what the Creator wanted them to do.
Right.
So you got this prophecy in the Book of Mormon. It was the gospel. It was the fullness of the gospel is all things common. Polygamy
right.
is a kind of a little bit, it's kind of an add-on, an aberration. It's not really needed unless your group of people is so small and Creator wants to build a large group of people in a short period.
Right, and if your men have been killed off. And,
exactly.
And, you know, destroyed by mobs or assassins or war.
The Book of Mormon says, it commands that everyone, every man will only have one wife.
Right.
And it talks about the terrible things that happen when men monkey around with this, but it says...
Concubines.
Yeah, but it says, nevertheless, you are my people, and I will command you to do what I want you to do. In other words, the door is left open in the Book of Mormon for polygamy.
Well, you have to kind of put it in perspective, too. It wasn't as if, you know, become a member of the church and you get as many wives as you
no.
want. Only 3% of the population practiced it, and you had to be called to it by the priesthood. And usually what happened were you had single women with children who could not, they had no trade, they had no skills, they didn't have women's ability to work or farm or do any kind of trade in those days. You usually took on a whole family, and
yeah.
you helped raise those kids. You provided for their clothing, their food, their education. It was definitely a duty.
Yeah. John Taylor, the third president, he had three wives. He had one in Canada, one in Utah, and one in Mexico. And he didn't even own a house. He was an itinerant father.
Well, it goes back further than that. I mean, people that say that, and you know, that polygamy is of the devil are going to have to face Father Jacob someday and his four wives,
mm-hmm.
who are the literal fathers of all the tribes we see today.
And Abraham.
And tell them they're going to hell.
Well, yeah, yeah. You know, you kind of wonder, what is it that Jesus means when he said, you know, that we would be ashamed of him?
Yes.
And you kind of wonder, you know, is he talking about polygamy? Because he had to have been married. And, you know, you only have a wedding feast to put on a wedding garment if you're getting married.
And the groom is the one that provides the new wine.
Yeah. And so the marriage at Cana was his marriage to Mary Ann.
Sure. Everybody knows that.
And a lot of people don't want to admit it, but...
Well,
now that,
long before Dan Brown popularized it in a mystery novel, we knew it to be true.
Well, they've got a genealogy of Jesus. They're starting to look into scriptures now and some of the other old records, and they're piecing together. You know, the Roman church wanted us to have the idea he was an only son. That's not true. He had... They know now that Joseph had a wife before he married Mary. He had several children and after. And
we also know about the time that Jesus was crucified, probably Joseph was dead.
Yeah, he had
because died. When he was dying on the cross, he reached down, or he actually spoke down, and told John the Beloved to take care of his mother. And
yeah.
The only way that a Jewish man would ask for that to happen is if Mary had no brothers, which she didn't, and if Joseph was dead.
Yeah, and you know, in the Hebrew tradition, if a man was barren, it was his brother's responsibility to seed the wife.
That's correct.
And that was,
one of the tricks that the Pharisees brought to Jesus when asking him about the ordinance of marriage. When a man dies and has no child by his wife, then the second brother marries the wife, and so on to the seventh brother, then whose wife is she? And Jesus, in almost mockery, said, "Ye do err, not knowing the scriptures, for they neither marry nor are given in marriage in the resurrection." But the word that he used was gameo, which is the civil marriage, not the temple sealing.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, there's so much, you know, and... you know, Joseph Smith and the early brethren in the church, they kind of were piecing things together. The problem was they didn't have a good Torah teacher. You can't really learn Torah without a good teacher. And they also swallowed the Talmud hook, line, and sinker.
Yes.
The Talmud was something that was really, really didn't... There's a lot of writings about Judaism and about the Christians that were written by the Romans. Apparently, the Jews really didn't look at that whole situation as being very important to write about until Constantine and the Gentile Christians who had
seized control of the church.
It wasn't just that. They had literally overlaid their own, replaced theology over the original theology.
Well, sure. They sewed into the fabric many pagan gods, including the worship of colors and metals and woods and all kinds of things,
exactly.
And made it as popular as they could. And when the metropolitan bishops, who had considerable power, would not go along with it, he had 60 of them beheaded.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the rest of them, mysteriously enough, fell right into line.
And it goes even further than that. You know, there was a lot that happened between 135 and 333 when Marcus was the first Gentile bishop, and there he's the person that they all go back and call the first pope. But, you know, it wasn't...
right.
It wasn't until... James, or Jacob, had 14 successors, Pakids. They were judges. The last Pakid was driven from Jerusalem in 135 A.D., and the last member of the original Nazarene sect was driven from Jerusalem in 333. And then...
But they weren't actually killed. They migrated.
No, they were just driven. They were just driven away.
Right.
And because Jerusalem was destroyed in 135, it was renamed Coptolina. The entire Holy Land was renamed, refaced, and between 135 and 333, and, the whole idea about, Jesus never would have worshipped except on Friday to Saturday Sabbath. And the Mormon Church, and even the Catholic Church, is starting to backwater now on the Sabbath because so much information is coming out. I know the Mormon Church recently said, well, we know now that the change of the worship date happened in degrees over a period of time, and people are starting to understand more about the Torah. But the Talmud, as we have it today, was something that was really a reactionary thing. Most of it was written in the medieval period, and you have a lot of really nasty responses to a lot of nasty things that happened, you know, back in the 3rd and 4th century, and between the 5th, 4th century and the 10th, 9th century, when so many Jews were murdered.
Well, not only that, you had wholesale confiscation of all texts, all manuscripts, all holy objects. The memorization of Scripture, knowledge of Scripture,
yeah,
was expunged from the earth, as people who simply knew a verse or were reported to have said a verse,
yeah,
were burned at the stake, hung, stoned,
yeah,
beheaded, drowned. And by the time the Gutenberg press was being designed, the entire old world was in complete religious ignorance.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The church/government being the only ones in possession of Scripture. Of course, these were very elaborately hand-written Bibles, which were, carefully redacted, mm-hmm, so as not to take away from the power of the church. And if Martin Luther had not been such a powerful and popular and distant figure from the center of the church, they would have assassinated him immediately. But and then when William Tyndale came along and started translating things into English, they eventually tracked him down, strangled him, and burned him at the stake.
Mm-hmm.
But we do have his translation in the King James Version of,
yep,
the Bible, which, although is translated fairly accurately and is more widely accepted than any of the other Bibles,
mm-hmm,
really isn't the most accurate translation. Probably Farrah Fenton's is the best translation.
Yep. Well, look at the Aramaic Bible.
Right.
You know, that's only been out. I know a friend of mine, the first Aramaic Bible sat at Oral Roberts University for 10 years and nobody even read it. And a friend of mine by the name of Del Griffin, he was a student. He had been a journalist for several years, decided to go back to school, decided he wanted to be a preacher. He got a hold of the Aramaic Bible. learned Hebrew, learned some Aramaic, ended up going over to the Holy Land, and then he began to discover all the prophecies about the house of Joseph and some of these other things. Started working with one of the rabbis over there, who's now in his 80s, but became quite a. He ended up working as an investigative journalist for the Jerusalem Post. Eventually, ended up being run out of the country by the secret police.
How about that?
Can't go
I
back.
I wonder who the chief of police was.
Well,
in cahoots with.
He can't go back unless the entire Security Council meets and says it's okay for him to come back.
Ah, that's
interesting.
Sounds like he's made the right people mad.
Yeah, and he's got the a year ago, I guess it was a year ago October, the Sanhedrin reconstituted itself in the city where they shut themselves down about 1,600 years ago. But and that's an interesting situation too, because and people are beginning even Pope John Paul was rediscovering Judaism. There's interesting things are going on, but people are looking at.
Yes, there are. Yes, there are interesting things going on, and what you see is that people, human beings, are because many people believe that the Spirit of the Lord or some holy energy is being poured all over the earth, and those people that are in tune with it, they're picking it up, and it doesn't matter if they're Baptist or Methodist or Jewish or what, they're going to pick up on it and they're going to feel it if they're in tune and if their souls are ready to accept this knowledge or this feeling. And what's going to happen is they're going to begin to doubt the traditions of the fathers, and they're going to start returning to the original spirit of the gospel.
Well, get this. Back in the 80s, a man who had gone to school with Billy Graham's sister, the exclusive high school, private high school that she went to. I can't remember the name of it. This man's name was Clint Van Nest, and Van Nest became a Baptist minister. Living in Florida, he discovered, and this is about the time some of the Dead Sea Scrolls are coming out, discovers some of these things. He more or less starts the Nazarene movement here. Ends up move, which has had spinoffs into Texas and some other places, actually moves to Israel. Converts to Judaism, is taken in, and he's now a lifetime member of the board of a Yemenite synagogue in Ra'ana, Israel. And he is actually able to, and see the hair split here, and the whole issue, and what Van Nest was able to convince the rabbinate of was that you can now legally be a member of the Nazarene sect of Orthodox Judaism and believe that Jesus was Mashiach. You just can't associate him with shtuf, which means you can't associate him with deity.
Huh.
So,
well,
see, this
that,
is the whole...
all of that is a far cry from the House of Graham.
Yeah. Yeah, it sure is. And this guy, he was an ex-Air Force crypto. He's a Mensen. He worked.
So he was a Mensen.
Oh, very smart, very very smart man. He was able to get it. He did a retranslation of Matthew, a reconstruction of Matthew, a retranslation of Book of Revelations. He has restored and is the 16th Pakid of the Nazarene sect, because if a sect is ever abandoned and then rediscovered, whoever rediscovers it becomes the new judge. And yours truly is one of his talmids or disciples.
I'm humbled.
I'll see you.
Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments. Hi, this is Will Bluehour speaking on behalf of Native Remedies. As the systems of the body are interrelated, proper functioning and health occurs when they are in balance and harmony, so it's important to consider taking a holistic approach to caring for your body. Provided that they are manufactured in the correct way, natural medicines can work quickly and safely to create holistic balance in the body to support systemic health, relieve ailments, and help prevent future disease.
Most natural remedies do not produce negative side effects, and unlike conventional medicine, natural remedies do not just mask symptoms, but they get to the root of the problem to support health and affect healing at the same time. Most homeopathics are even safely taken by people of all ages and during pregnancy. Homeopathic medicine is actually suppressed here in the United States. Outside of this country, a large majority of medicines that are prescribed are homeopathics. Did you know that the cure for malaria was developed by the man that invented the homeopathic system? That's right. So friends, please take my advice. Visit the front page of prophecykeepers.com and click on the Native Remedies banner and find out what all the excitement's all about.
Well, I mean, it's no big deal, but I rediscovered this information, and but this whole idea, you know, the Jews, you know, under the law, you know, and Jesus never would have, he taught the law. He taught the law of Moses. And in the Book of Mormon, they talk about the law of Moses.
Right.
The rub between us and them is whether or not you can assign deity to a person. See, the Jews don't have any problem with a man like being a saint, and they don't really have a problem with a very, very special man that might come along once in 1,000 years or two that God was so close to that, you know, and Jesus said, you know, that, you know, I sit at the right hand of God. You know, he told John in the last chapter of the Book of Mormon, or Book of Revelations, don't worship me, you know, worship God. But it's really hazy because he also, the Lamb also accepted worship. And you know, so it's the New Testament's kind of back and forth and up and down, and you kind of wonder, well, what's going on here? Do we lose something in translation? But the problem that the Jews have with the Christians is that, you know, it wasn't that, you know, Jesus, you know, it's like one of the English speaking judges on the Revived Sanhedrin told me, he said Jesus said some good things. He said, but when you start saying he is a god or a member of a godhead, or say, he says that's idolatry, and you know,
well, it's not idolatry.
He's got a
point. It isn't. They called it blasphemy because it violated the traditions of the fathers. But as I understand my reading of the Book of Mormon, when Nephi came across the water with the settlers that were on the ship with him, he decided not to teach the traditions of the fathers to his people. He stayed to the pure religion.
Well, yeah, but they did teach the law of Moses.
Yes, the law of Moses, but they didn't teach the traditions of the fathers.
Yeah,
the traditions of the fathers were the customs and the practices that the almost like corruptions that had infiltrated the law of Moses and made it so rigid that the law itself became what was worshipped.
Yeah.
And not God.
Well, they didn't have the same priesthood set up. They of course they didn't have any Levites with them, so they went back apparently to the previous priesthood set up. So this really opens up, you know, hey, what was really going on there? You know, because it was very clear from what Moses wrote. And Jesus never claimed to be anything other than a son of man.
Right.
And when he was buttonholed by Caiaphas and asked if he was the Messiah. And the whole, see, during that period of time, it was known that the Messiah was probably going to show up. And during that period of time, there was probably no less than 50 guys running around, more or less doing the same thing. There were healings that were going on. There was a lot of excitement that was going on. And then you had this rub on the Sanhedrin between, you know, the ones that believed in the resurrection and the ones that didn't. And nothing really was going on. Nobody was really, you know, looking real hard at Jesus until he
turned 30.
Well, no, until he brought back Lazarus from the dead. Now we're talking about Book of John, I believe it's or Second John, chapter 11. I believe it's. So you start with the resurrection of Lazarus. So,
well, it wasn't a resurrection.
Yeah,
he was just bringing back to life.
Okay.
Lazarus was not a resurrected being.
Yeah, he brought him back from the dead. So
right.
So somebody runs to Sanhedrin and gets them all excited. So they quit coming and they're talking, and you know, and of course the implications are everybody's really, I mean, they're not worried about whether it's Jesus the Messiah or not. They're worried about Rome and losing their country.
Well, I think they were worried more about losing their power,
well,
losing their hold on the church. Because
exactly. Caiaphas said, he said to these guys, and you can read it in the King James Version, he says, you know nothing. He says, you don't understand what's going on here. And the King James Version says, because he was high priest that year, he was prophesying. And he says, he prophesied that it was Jesus' destiny to die for the nation, and not only for the nation, but all of scattered Israel abroad. And from that point forward, they decided to kill him. So now you have the same people that a few days before were heralding him as the Messiah. All of a sudden they're saying, crucify him, let his blood be upon us.
And our generation. But that, I don't think that's not totally accurate. I think that the Pharisees and the Sanhedrin, being feared and respected among the people, interspersed themselves in the crowd, and they were the ones that instigated the call for crucifixion.
James,
and people, like the contagion feeders that they are, smell blood in the water, and
exactly.
They went for it.
Well, later on,
Caiaphas tried everything. I mean, he tried giving up Barabbas, he tried scourging,
yeah.
He tried everything to get out of that because of his wife's dream,
yeah.
And because he really didn't see anything wrong with Jesus. He didn't want to take the action that he did. He was reluctant.
But go back
he took it.
Go back and read that about that, where Caiaphas actually prophesied that it was the destiny of Jesus to die for the nation and all Israel scattered, and from that forward, point forward, they decided to kill him. Oh, isn't that strange? Why would they say such? Why would such a thing be recorded and be overlooked as being what they were thinking of 2,000 years ago?
So the implication is that the high priest Caiaphas wasn't necessarily in a jealous rage, but was rather wanting to participate and fulfill.
Yeah.
The prophecy that he was in fact the Messiah.
Exactly, and he corrected them. He said, "You know nothing." They were worried that if he was the Messiah, what Rome was going to do, because they were worried about losing their country, and because they were had an autonomous kingdom of sorts under Rome. They wondered what the Romans. See, Rome didn't really care what the Jews did as long as they didn't pick up arms.
Yeah, as long as they didn't pick up arms and as long as they continued to pay their tribute.
That's right.
But the traditions of the fathers were that when the Messiah came, he was coming to defeat the Romans and run them out of their country. And that's not what Jesus came to do. When he said that he was going to come and free the people, he meant freedom from sin,
right.
Not freedom from the Romans.
Well, the thing that he was pointing out, the revolution that he was trying to get going, was that love was already part of the law of Moses. They had just forgotten about it.
Exactly. That's exactly
that's right.
That's so well said. Exactly.
That's
right.
All it came down to. All the rest is window dressing. All the rest is obfuscation. All the rest is just confusion.
Right. Thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself.
And you know the question.
And love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, mind, and strength. Upon these two hang all the commandments.
And you know, he never, like I said, you know, what he said to incense Caiaphas was that you will see me coming in the clouds of heaven, you know, with the angels. That really incensed him. But little known thing, 40 days before before this event happened, there was somebody going around Jerusalem saying that Jesus was going to be charged with sorcery.
That's
so there was a movement afoot. There was just things that were going on that
Well, you know, you had Simon the magician who had, of course, this is long after after Jesus' crucifixion, but he tried to buy the power to convey the Holy Ghost from Peter.
Right. Yeah, that's Simon.
So there was still not a clear understanding of the divinity. And I don't even think Peter understood it until after he went through the soul-wrenching experience of denying the Christ three times, exactly as Jesus prophesied. And when he went through that, it just literally just broke his heart. And when he recovered from that, he was a new man.
Yeah, and James said later, and I believe it was in the book of Acts, that it was a few lawless men that were responsible for... He really didn't hold the Sanhedrin responsible. There was a few lawless men, he said, that were responsible for...
That's the case with even our government today.
Yep.
People say, oh, the government is doing this, or the government's running black projects, or the government is withholding information. It's actually a few lawless, untouchable men. They may even be in the Pentagon itself that believe that the people are too stupid or too unvisionary to allow the government to dabble in the things in which they dabble.
Well, you know what Rockefeller said? He said, you know, back in the 20s and 30s when they set up this, well, you hear about rich people having trust funds.
Yeah.
Well, you know what he said was, own nothing, control everything.
Right.
And that's what they do. The whole idea of a non-profit organization was set up to shelter them.
Sure.
You know, their homes, their cars, their estates, they're all put up either under, I'm talking through my hat here a little bit, but a lot of them are irrevocable trusts. Non-profit trusts, you know.
Well, that's kind of the argument we're going through with this Fair Tax Act. They make it out to be that it's the poor that are going to be greatly hurt by this. But in reality, it's going to be the mega-rich that are hurt most by this.
Yeah.
Who spends more money, poor people or rich people? Well, rich people do. And that means when they spend their money, they're going to pay the tax.
Oh, yeah. They have to go to just a value-added tax instead of,
And the interesting thing is, with a value-added tax, you pick up all the people that get paid in cash.
Yeah.
You pick up the tourists.
Yeah.
You pick up all of the people that cheat on their taxes. They won't have to cheat anymore.
That's right.
Make all the money you want.
That's right.
And don't worry about it. You don't have to disclose anything to the government. You don't have to worry about them invading your privacy.
Yeah.
But when you spend your money, you pay the tax. And if you don't want to pay the tax, then don't spend
your
money.
Right.
It's simple. It is so simple, and it's constitutional.
Well, you know what Jefferson said was the fairest form of taxation?
The Constitution says it's the only form of taxation.
The
federal government has the right to levy.
Well, he says the lottery was the best idea. It's completely voluntary.
Sure it is.
Yeah.
It's a tax on the stupid.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Unless you're
you know, we could make money by selling yesterday's lottery tickets for half price.
Yeah.
They only have one less chance of winning.
Oh, gee. Well, I don't want to keep you too late. It's been a real frolic here tonight.
Oh, as it usually is. We have a ball when we talk.
I tell you, this year, you know, and I wanted to say earlier, and I want everybody to hear this, and I have a reason for not revealing what exactly I'm talking about here, but I will tell you, back about 20 years ago, I was told that a certain thing would happen shortly before the end. That thing's happened now, folks, and I've learned a lot in this last year. And oddly enough, it all happened because a friend of mine who's a Book of Mormon believer, and I still love this guy, but I thought he started looking into the protocols of the Elders of Zion. And the protocols, and he started wondering, because we talk about prophecy a lot, he started wondering if the protocols weren't some kind of prophecy, because it talked about a MasterCard. But he's been poor for a long time, as have I, And I kind of noticed, you know, a lot of Christians, without really knowing it, you know, because of the things, information that's going around about the Illuminati, and, you know, a lot of people accuse the Jews of running or controlling the world, and a guy I correspond with in Israel by the name of Barry Chamish, chamish.com, he's written two books that prove that the Jewish people have suffered more from the Illuminati than the Gentiles. But anyway, this friend of mine was dabbling around with the protocols, and the protocols were written into a novel in Russia in the 1850s, and they kind of took on a life of their own, and in the 1890s, the Russian secret police used them as an excuse to persecute Jews, and Adolf Hitler built the Third Reich on this myth. So anyway, I end up, you know, splitting the sheets with, at least religiously, with my friend. I mean, we're friends, still friends, you know. I just started looking at Judaism to see, you know, because I was trying to point. So he's a Book of Mormon expert, but uh-huh. I was trying to point out things to him in the Book of Mormon that he wasn't looking at. You know, he was looking at the Book of Mormon to the exclusion of all other scripture. And,
well, we're not supposed to do that.
Well, I told him, I said, read your Book of Mormon. I said, the Book of Mormon says that the Jew would write, that the Gentile would write.
Yeah, the stick of Judah, the stick of Joseph.
And guess who else would write? It also says a third group would write, the lost tribes. What have we got now? The Colbran. I'm wondering if the Colbran is that third set of scriptures that was prophesied to come forth in the Book of Mormon. What do you think?
I don't know. I haven't heard of it.
It's really interesting. It's Colbrin. It's a body of ancient knowledge or scripture that was passed down in Britain for 2,000 years. And it purports to contain some teaching, direct teachings of Jesus. There's been shows on Coast to Coast about it, so I'll send you a link about it.
Yeah, do that. I want to learn a little bit more about that.
Go to youwusa.com, and you can read about youwusa.com. You can read about the Colbran Bible.
Okay.
I've gone through some changes in my outlook, and what I found out was that a lot of Christians are really, they're not anti-Semitic, they're something called Miso-Judaic, which means they really don't understand Jews to the point of hurting them. It's a hair split. They're not actively, I mean, even the people that, you know, your average evangelical Christian in this country. I mean, they, you know, they support Israel, but...
Well, they do it because the scripture says that the nation that fights against Israel will be destroyed.
Right.
So they still don't, no matter what, we have to support Israel.
They still don't understand Israel. But the interesting thing about Netzarim, and that's netzarim.co.il, Clint Van Nest, who is now... who has a card from the State of Israel, says that he's a Jew. He's been renamed Yirmiyahu Ben Dawid. Of course, when you become an Israeli citizen, you take a Hebrew name.
Sure.
But he says it's the only religion that can heal the entire world.
We'll see you. Be sure and stay tuned. We'll be returning in just a few moments.
Friends, this is Will Bluewater speaking on behalf of WiseFoods.org. Our native ancestors stored away lots of food in case of emergencies. Thousands of years of sad experience taught them to be prepared. The traditional Hopi stored food enough to last for 7 years. So did the early Mormons. Nowadays, everyone unwisely depends on supermarkets for their food supply, and few people know that there is only a 3-day supply of food in the American food supply chain.
Now, should some disaster befall us that would cause the big trucks like I used to drive to cease delivering our food, you'd be in big trouble. It is for these reasons that my family purchased a year's supply of 3 different breakfast and 10 delicious dinner entrees from wisefoods.org. These foods are freeze-dried right at the field where they are picked and processed, and are fresher and more nutritious than any supermarket food. You just add hot water, and they're good for 25 years being stored. A year's supply from wisefoods.org fits in an area about 4.5 feet by 4 feet by 18 inches. I can literally get it all in the back seat area of my Honda Civic. If you stay at home, you won't need to go to a FEMA refugee center should some disaster happen. Did you know that David Ramsey, David Gallagher, Laura Ingram, and Michael Medved have also invested in Wise Foods? Why don't you visit wisefoods.org today and see why.
It can heal the rift between Christianity and Judaism. It can heal the rift between Judaism and Islam.
And what religion is that?
Whatever information he could put together after the Dead Sea Scrolls came out on the original Nazarene sect, which was a bona fide sect of or stream of Israel during the time of Jesus, and it's a sect that John the Baptist belonged to and Jesus belonged to. It's the
Nazarene sect. What we affectionately in modern days call them Gnostics?
Nope. They're... Netzarim, and the interesting thing about Netzer means branch.
Ah.
See, the Book of Mormon, Mormon fundamentalists have been looking for the branch prophet for a long time. And they've been looking for a man whose name is the branch. And I didn't know about this. I learned certain things to look for back in the 80s. And then when I found out the word Netzer means branch, and that Jesus was part of this branch, Nazarene sect, it's really interesting. It's really interesting. We start looking into it. And
well, I know when we look in Isaiah about the root and stem of Jesse, we know who those two individuals are.
Yeah, and then there's a branch to come forth.
And then there's a branch.
Mm-hmm. Root, stem, and branch. So. But anyway, I'll tell you... I kind of look at people look at prophecy as kind of being a muddled kind of mess, but if you really study it, it gives you a roadmap.
It sure does. It
just gives you hints.
What you have to do is not be prejudiced,
mm-hmm.
and you can't have any guile in your heart, and you got to read it with the same spirit with which it was written.
Yep.
And
well,
many people don't do that.
Well, it was a tough jump for me. You know, my friend now looks at me and, you know, he probably thinks I'm a heathen because he probably thinks that I don't believe that Jesus is a deity of some kind. But you know what? You know, there's all kinds of evidence. The original Book of Mormon before it was changed, the 1835 version.
I've held one in my hand.
Well, I've got, you can buy a photocopy of it. The Reorganized Church sells them. Just put an 1835 Book of Mormon into eBay and you can buy one for $25. But that original translation called the Palmyra or the Printer's Edition said, when Abinadi stood before
King Noah,
he said that God himself would come down and redeem mankind.
Yes.
And Jesus, it was almost like my friend really firmly believes that Jesus is God the Father. But I kept reminding him, Dick, I said, you've got evidence to support it. You also got evidence over here, most of which Jesus himself said personally. Like, I mean, how can you be the Father and sit at your own right hand? You know what I mean?
How can you pray to yourself or commend yourself into your own spirit or ask yourself to take the cup away from yourself?
Yeah,
It doesn't make any sense. God and his Son, Christ, are two separate individuals.
Right. And
their age and origin, maybe we're too mortal to understand it.
Yeah.
That much is clear.
It's like they were so close. And when you begin to understand the three things that a Hebrew holy man can be, you can be three things. You can be one of them, or two of them, but only the Messiah would be all three. When you begin to understand what Moses taught about what how holy a man could be, you begin to understand that there's a very fine line. And when you go back in the Old Testament, you read where God himself says, no, there's not going to be any other gods before me.
And Jesus also didn't try to put himself before
no,
God.
And God says, and God, the Old Testament teaches that no other God is needed, no mediator is needed, for salvation. And, so it's just a lot of things roll around in my head for a while. I was really kind of conflicted about it because I knew the Romans, they kind of invoked the old Mithras cult where man becomes God. But really what it comes down to is that God can become a man. So I believe Jesus became so godlike that you really couldn't split the Father out of him, that the Father indwelled him.
Sure. I mean, he told the Pharisees and he told Pilate, I do nothing save I have seen the Father
yep.
do it.
Yeah, and when you've seen the Father, you've seen me. And it's
right.
a mystery. You know, it all goes back with it. Native Americans always say, don't argue about Great Spirit. You'll never. It, you just won't allow it. You don't argue about Great Spirit. Well, listen, I'm running out of battery and appreciate you being on the show.
Well, listen, we don't need to let as much time go between now and
next
time we talk.
You betcha.
We are quickly becoming brothers,
When did your book come out?
It comes out in January.
Let's begin in January.
You'll be able to buy it, of course, Barnes & Noble and Joseph Beth booksellers and Davis Kidd booksellers, and various independents are picking it up now. Or you can always go to the website at www.arkofmillionsofyears.com. Make sure you spell that A-R-K like Noah's Ark.
Right.
And you can go to the online store and buy it there. And by the way, if you buy Volume 1 now, you'll get a 10% discount on Volume 2. We'll have your email address when you buy it at the website, and we will send you a newsletter that the book is coming out, and you just send us your code that we send you in that newsletter, and you can pick up the book for 10% off.
And there's a link on the page that people are listening to this interview from to your website. Well, let you go before we get disconnected.
All right.
Hey, thanks a lot, Dr. Brooks.
Thank you, my brother.
Hey,
I'll talk to you later.
Hey, bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to the Wisdom of the Elders on Prophecy Keepers Radio, revealing closely guarded ancient secrets here in the modern information age of Aquarius. This station's only means of support is through donations and purchases of the Prophecy Keepers Trilogy and Preparedness Library, which includes lifetime online access to a printable 1,000-page intelligence briefing, and a worldwide indigenous prophecy encyclopedia. Now, folks, there's nothing else like this collection on the planet. You'll receive instant access to the Prophecy Keeper's Wisdom Treasury Vault. This is a huge 4.88 gigabyte library, 3,287 files and 222 folders. It includes the Prophecy Keeper's Prepper's Self-Reliance files and all of our previous over 100 Prophecy Keepers interviews. So head on over to prophecykeepers.com right now and have a free sneak peek today of two-thirds of the Prophecy Keepers trilogy and a peek of the dashboard of the Prophecy Keepers Wisdom Treasury Vault.
seeking.